Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. This week's episode is a special one. We're going to do a tribute to the longtime sports writer Frank DeFord, who spent decades at Sports Illustrated and NPR. He died, as we're taping this a couple days ago, at age 78. And we're going to have reflections from six of the finest sports writers in the country: Alex Wolff, Wright Thompson, Jack McCallum, Sally Jenkins, Tim Layden, and Michael Farber. So a special edition of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and we start off with the fine writer himself, Alex Wolff, who wrote the obit for Sports Illustrated on Frank DeFord. Okay, and we start this special episode of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Alex Wolff, the fine longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated. And Alex got the assignment to write the obituary for Sports Illustrated on Frank DeFord. Alex Wolff joins us on the phone. And Alex, that's not an easy assignment, Alex. I know you knew Frank for a long time, but how did you approach this? I mean, I thought you wrote a beautiful piece, but was there joy in writing it? Was it tough to write? Just describe when you got the assignment and how you approached it.
Well, Frank's health had been failing for a while, so we talked in-house about trying to get something ready. I did speak to a few people, Gabe Miller in our copy department particularly. Here's somebody who's seen, you know, for the last 30, 35 years, has been the first person to get a look at what Frank filed. And I know he was a great admirer of Frank as a person. And so I wanted to talk to Gabe. I reread a lot of things that Frank not only had written, but had written about the craft, introductions to a couple of his anthologies. And then I was, truth be told, about halfway through rereading over time his memoir when I got the call on Memorial Day. It was about 1:32 in the afternoon from the office that Frank had died. And, I was caught a little bit unawares, but had done a lot of thinking over the last few weeks about what he meant. And the thing that kept coming up, and I was reminded of as I read a few of his old pieces, was just the humanity at the essence of who he was as a writer. And maybe it was easier to be that in another time, when you were actually flying first class and John Havlicek was in coach, when you had a time-make expense account. And the guys on the team wanted to go out with you because you had that expense account and they weren't being paid any money. And so you actually were able to strike up these relationships that revealed these athletes not as gods, but as real people. And you know, Frank had a very charmed life up to the point where he and Carol found out that their newborn daughter had cystic fibrosis. And I think there was actually a change in his oeuvre of work. It seemed like after Alex's death, he was much more interested in writing about people. You'll see in his body of work up until about 1980, he loved to go and chase down these stories about Little Irvy, the 20-ton frozen whale, or roller derby, or the Miss America pageant. And then after that, he particularly was drawn to people who you'd think people really didn't want to like, you know, but Jimmy Connors or Bob Knight or Howard Cosell, and just had this kind of homing instinct where he would find the humanity in these people and then tell these lovely stories about them. So I think it was the decency of him as a human being that just kept revealing itself to me again and again as I reread his work, but also read a little bit about his upbringing in life.
How long did it take you to write the obit?
Well, I didn't have but 2 hours, really. I mean, I had a lot of disconnected stuff in a Word file, you know, half-formed thoughts and a few quotes, and I felt we would all feel so terribly self-conscious writing about Frank DeFord. I remember when Tom Verducci wrote that lovely piece about Roger Angel. I mean, how do you write, as a great baseball writer as Tom is, how do you write about the man who wrote most poetically and prolifically about that same sport? So, you know, I was very conscious of that. I was conscious of how Frank didn't like to use quotes. So I wanted to make sure that just as he made every quote count, it had to pass clear a really high bar before he would use it in a piece. It had to serve his purposes. I wanted to make sure, okay, if I'm going to quote Myra Gelband or I'm going to quote Gabe Miller, that these are going to be quotes that really pack some punch. And I think they did. I mean, I thought what Myra said about a Frank piece, which was he hung bells throughout it, and then at the end he'd go back and ring every one. I mean, that's just beautiful. And I've been rereading the piece just this morning that he wrote on Steve Coffin when he was Sportsman of the Year in 1977, because our good friend and colleague Ted Keith wants to run it annotated on SI.com. And I've been having a blast reading that. And that's such a great example of Frank's approach and how he would just drop these little breadcrumbs throughout a piece. But yeah, it was a rush job. But sometimes, you know this, and you wrote yours, Richard, under the same circumstances. You know, the web waits for no one. And there's just something about how the mind gets focused when you get shocking news like that, and you just try to do the very best you can. And usually, in the case of somebody like Frank, whom you really know and adored professionally and personally, it's in those moments, I think, that the essence of that person reveals itself to you. You know, it's the deadline adrenaline and all, but again, it's somebody who is really close to you, and through your emotions, you kind of find that thread and follow it.
Alex, you and Frank share an alma mater, Princeton, but honestly, I don't know how well you knew him and when you first might have met him. How often did your paths come across during your professional career?
Well, I found out in the last 24 to 48 hours that I'm one of so many people who just blindly approached Frank at some very vulnerable point in my life when, you know, I was just some pissant and said, hey, look at me. I'd like to do what you do. What can you do? I mean, Karen Krause of The Times told me that she had the same experience. It turns out Grant Wall practically stalked him, which he shared online. And the graciousness with which he would deal with us all, you know, suffer us all, I guess would be the way to put it, was something that clearly wasn't just my experience. But I did have one shortly after I joined the staff in the early 80s. Frank and Carol had just adopted Scarlett, their daughter. It was a couple years after Alex had died, and we did a letter from the publisher in the front of the magazine, and those are ghostwritten. And I was asked to go out to Westport, Connecticut, to talk to Frank about his new daughter, which was a very, very broad and personal and private thing. And he was very gracious and obviously was on board for sharing with the world that he and Carol were going to adopt after he'd written this wrenching memoir about Alex's life and death. So that was really my first interaction with Frank. And then we were, you know, colleagues, and mash notes would go back and forth from time to time. I mean, there was a trade deficit in that. He sent me many more than I sent him, and of course I was much less deserving. But always just that sense of the craft that we were in this thing together, that the magazine was this huge institution that we were both stewards of in some way. You know, I remember Peter Carey telling me that Frank DeFord submitted more ideas than anyone else on the writing staff.
Hmm.
And they weren't things for him to do. They were just things he thought SI should do. He was a guy who worked as hard as anybody. And then, of course, his best stuff was, you know, was for the ages. So it was a privilege to be his colleague. I mean, I hope that came through in the open.
Alex, you're, at least in terms of our staff, probably no one has read more of Frank's work in the last week than you have. So there's obviously sort of a great number of pieces you can choose from. But are there particular pieces that stay with you the most? And if there are, why would you choose those pieces?
Well, the one that I'm kind of entangled with most right now is, and that's because I'm editing an anthology for the Library of America of basketball writing. And the piece of Frank's we've chosen for that is his Bob Knight profile. Mm. I fact-checked that once upon a time.
I did not know that. That's amazing. You fact-checked that piece? Wow.
I fact-checked that piece and had to call Knight on a few things, including a little detail Frank had in there about how Knight on a trip to New York City with the Ohio State Varsity for the Holiday Festival had shoplifted a tie from some shop in Times Square. Our Columbus stringer, Kay Kessler, had been on that trip and had seen the whole thing happen. And there was this long silence on the phone line when I asked Knight if that was true. But that's a whole other story. We could do that, take that up in some other podcast. The point being that here was somebody that I've had a very fraught relationship with, you know, later on, Bob Knight, and I've been actually accused by Indiana fans as being the one who has an anger management problem, not Coach Knight, as a result of things I've written about him. And here Frank wrote this just Olympian piece about him that didn't even come close to being a hit job, but was so objective and so fair and so empathetic. And you know, Bob Knight probably didn't deserve to be treated that well. And it just stands up. And the thing I love about that piece, Richard, I just have to tell you, and why it's going into this anthology, is it's called The Rabbit Hunter. It's all about how Bob Knight would chase these insignificant things, and that was his undoing. He was always chasing rabbits. And if you remember back in 2000, he's been put on super secret probation by Indiana. You know, one more thing, zero tolerance, he'd be out of there. And it was some undergraduate who passed him on campus and said, "Hey, Knight, what's up?" And it just occurred to me the other day that this was Bugs Bunny. This was another rabbit. A guy almost literally said to him, "What's up, Doc?" And that led to him being fired by the university. And because he grabbed the cost of the kid after he said that because he thought he'd been rude to him. And to me, that was Frank DeFord. He could lay this thing out 20 years before that incident on the IU campus in 2000. He'd written this piece and foretold what would happen. It would be a rabbit who would undo Bob Knight. So, you know, for all of his virtues, Frank was almost clairvoyant.
Alex, one of the things I think this is from your piece, where you wrote, repetition and callbacks were among his tricks, as was an acute feel for the architecture and pacing of a piece. Was that from your obit? Am I correct about that?
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Okay. So, style, I mean, you're someone who's always been interested in sort of stylists and sort of stylistically how a writer will approach a piece. When you look at the architecture of a DeFord piece, would you say repetition and callbacks were sort of what he was most known for, to sort of set something up at the beginning and then ultimately come back to it? As Myra Gelband said, once he sort of had something, he wanted to sort of ring that theme over and over again. His pieces, they're too complex for me, but his pieces are kind of, I would imagine if you were like one of those English professors, must be just like kind of fascinating to deconstruct.
Well, and that's what I'm doing right now with this Steve Cawthon story, which is actually a great example of him using that technique. Cawthon was, you know, he was this high school senior when he was our Sportsman of the Year, and he referred to what he did as race riding, which had this slightly off sound to it. You know, it was what Steve Cawthon described being a jockey as, and Frank kind of grabbed this phrase, and it appears again and again in the piece, race riding. But there are a handful of other things he has that run through that piece. Things about sort of high school life, because Cawthon had come from this little high school in Walton, Kentucky, and he had this way of going on these four, five, six sentence flights, Frank did, where he would describe something that we all recognize. And in this case, very early, it's the feel, the sound, the smells of the institution that is a high school. And there in the first two paragraphs, he has us right in this little high school, this thing we've all experienced. And I think that was Frank's secret sauce for winning the confidence of the reader. You know, today we live in this time where we're all divided by so many things. There's so little in terms of a common experience. None of us watch Cronkite, you know, at 6 or 7 in the evening every night the way once upon a time we did. And when Frank was at his height, there was more of that he could call on to kind of bring everyone into a common place so he could then tell the story where we all contextually were comfortable with where we were sitting there at his knee. And that was the beauty of it, because Frank could just be this confident narrative voice. And that's why you see the phrase, you see, of course, and so. And you see these little DeFord tropes again and again in his piece, because he's in your ear, you know. And in many ways, people say, oh, all that stuff he did for NPR, those short little commentaries, they're so different from those long magisterial bonus pieces. But they weren't really, because you could pull, I was thinking of this in the coffin pieces I've been annotating it, you could pull a handful of these little flights he had in the coffin piece and say, oh, that's the germ of an NPR commentary. You know, the linoleum clicks of the heels in a high school on the floor, or the smell of it, the institutional janitorial product smell, whatever that is. I mean, you could see Frank taking and running that with that as an NPR commentary. But he would drop these things into his long bonus pieces about personalities, so you were getting the best of both of him in them. And I think it was a way he just kind of projected his humanity on all of us who were readers of his stuff, and we in turn went with him. You know, we would go along with wherever he would want to lead us.
I love the it's more of a relative new DeFord piece, but like when he's writing about Bill Russell. And I don't know how often he did this, but he put himself in the piece in the beginning of the piece where he said he's riding with Bill Russell, and Bill Russell says something like, I'm sorry, I'd like to be your friend, but I can't. And DeFord's like saying, but I thought we were friends. And then Russell has this amazing sort of quote about friendship and how much it takes, and that they're heading in different directions, and no, they can't be friends. So it's just that Russell piece that Frank DeFord wrote, which I believe was in 1999. It even shows you sort of that he's able to also put himself in a piece, and it's not so self-referential and, you know, sort of like the today's sort of television me. He really was. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of praise and tribute to Frank DeFord, but he's like one of the guys I think who just truly deserves it. He really was a master craftsman, and we're not going to see his likes again.
No, and he was perfectly matched for his time. You know, that was a time where you really could get to know the other. He was a real friend of Arthur Ashe's.
Right.
They really cared about each other, and that was an important part of his life. The most moving part of his memoirs, when he writes about his relationship with Ashe. And I think today, you know, he called sports blogging the pole dancing of journalism. That it would be harder, and I think that series of events that led him to go off to do the National and so forth, that was a restlessness that was born of a little bit of frustration, that it just was harder to get the time he needed to just collect the texture and the sense of who a person was in order to render that person's life the way he was accustomed to doing, which is what we all expected as readers. And he'd be wasted on today's sports landscape. I'm sorry to say, that doesn't mean he wouldn't find another way to bring to bear that great sensibility, you know, as a writer. And maybe that's why he ended up doing so many of the commentaries at the end, because he wasn't dependent on getting all that hanging around time that you had to have to do a bonus. But it is such a different world today, as we know all too well. And I'm just grateful we have, you know, now between hard covers and a lot of places, some of his very greatest things are on the SI Vault. You know, it's a treat. I mean, if you were teaching an English course, you could do a whole lot worse than just assign a Frank piece every week.
That's well said. Alex Wolf, longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated, obviously author of many, many books. And he drew the assignment to write the obituary for Frank DeFord for Sports Illustrated. I don't think there was a better person, at least on our staff, who could have done that. Alex, you lead us off. We'll be coming up with Wright Thompson, Jack McCallum, Sally Jenkins, Tim Layden, Michael Farber, many of those people, or maybe all of those people you know, certainly many of those guys you worked with for decades. So I appreciate you starting this off today. I wanted to get reflections of Frank, and I don't think there was a better place to start than you. So thank you very much for being part of today's Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure to talk about Frank and the great work he did.
All right, our thanks to Alex Wolf for really thoughtful remembrances of Frank DeFord. And now we bring in Wright Thompson, the fine senior writer for ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine. And people who've listened to this podcast are certainly familiar with Wright's work. He was a guest on this podcast a couple of months ago. And he is a great lover of sports journalism, and that is one of the reasons I wanted to bring him in. Right, one of the things you said to me when we were emailing each other was that a good profile is true now, a great profile becomes true forever. That was pretty poignant. Nice job, by the way, poignancy in an email. It doesn't always happen. And I feel like that's DeFord in a nutshell. These profiles, whether it's Bob Knight or Jimmy Connors or The Boxer and the Blonde or the Schmeling profile, I mean, these will stand the test of time 100, 200 years from now. So that's my long preamble for you to, when you read DeFord, what stands out to you?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One, like you said, I mean, that Bobby Knight profile, which ran, what, 1981, 82?
Yep.
I mean, that story was both true when it ran, and it was a prophecy. Like, it foretold everything that was going to happen in Bobby Knight's life. And, like, I mean, those stories hold up. You don't read them and be like, boy, he sure got snookered. You know, I mean, so it holds up both in terms of his ability to see what was right there to be seen, but most people missed. And then, like, the style holds up. I mean, it's not dated. You don't read it and be like, well, that was written in the 80s. You know what I mean? Like that's Bobby Knight profile could run in Sports Illustrated right now, untouched, and would not seem out of place. And I mean, that's sort of staggering, really. I mean, so beyond the fact that he writes beautifully, I mean, I just have sort of like, I mean, a lot, I went back and read a bunch of stories after he died, and like, you know, like The Boxer and the Blonde, he was like, you know, before the forlorn simplicity of a depression was buried in a thick braided rubble of blood and spam. I mean, if that's not the best description of World War II ever, just in the middle of a paragraph, and his stories are full of those, but to me, I mean, what's more than the writing is just the obvious emotional intelligence to see what's really going on.
Right. The people who I'm talking to for this podcast, particularly Tim Layden, Jack McCallum, Michael Farber, Alex Wolf, they're all of a certain age where DeFord would have had a major impact on them in their 20s, their sort of formative writing years right out of college. It's a little different for you, obviously, because you're younger than those guys.
I'm a Gary Smith guy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm of that.
So what I was going to get to is, like, for your formative, if Gary Smith is sort of your guy, when you were in your 20s, what if anything, did DeFord represent to you as you were sort of starting on your path at the Kansas City Star and ultimately landing at ESPN?
Well, I mean, I reread The Boxer and the Blonde, 2 days ago. I mean, DeFord is so sophisticated that, I mean, I didn't learn anything then. I mean, I had no idea what he was doing or why. I still, like, I went back and read the Bobby Knight story. I defy someone to outline that for me. You know what I mean? Like, there is an arc, and there is an emotional resonance and payoff. But, I mean, seriously, like somebody sit down with a pen and a piece of paper and really try to figure out why he's telling you what he's telling you in the order he's telling it to you. Like, and I'm sure maybe he wouldn't even be able to tell you. Maybe it's just so instinctual. You know, it's interesting to me. You know, a thousand questions you wish you'd asked. But, I mean, I had no idea in college, other than the fact that I was like, well, it's like listening to Sergeant Pepper's. You're like, well, I don't even know how they sat down and did that. So they were much more like North Stars than teaching tools. They're just way too good for a college student to even really understand what's going on in them.
That's interesting. One of the things that Alex Wolf said in his obit of Frank, he said repetition and callback were among his tricks, as was an acute feel for the architecture and pacing of a piece. When you read DeFord, what strikes you in terms of repetition and calling back, and particularly sort of how he sets a piece up? One of the things that the essay editors, I guess, always noted with Frank would be that if he would really sort of ring the bell over and over again if he felt he had a theme that was really interesting to a reader.
I mean, my thing is that you don't really notice those things unless you're looking for them. I mean, that's the trick. I mean, if you know, they become gimmicky when they stand out. I mean, now that I've heard that obviously, you know, whether it's the, you know, their callbacks in Max Schmeling, you know, the do you know what I mean in the Bill Russell, is that what he says? Let me find it. I'm going to pull that up right now, the Bill Russell story.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's just doing his thing. Like, it's not flashy. I mean, like, you read that Bill Russell story, and it's not for about 900 words do you really realize, oh, my God, this is a story about 100 years in America. I mean, he's not jumping up and down. Look, there, here it is. I found it. By then, you know, you're talking about Charlie, Bill Russell's grandfather, who I think was the first free man in their family.
Wow.
By then, his grandson had become the first African-American coach in a major professional sport. Jake sat with his son, Charlie, watching Bill closely during timeouts. He wasn't quite sure what he was seeing. Celtic huddles could be terribly democratic back then. It was before teams had a lot of assistants with clipboards. Skeptically, Jake asked his son, "He's the boss?" Charlie nodded. Jake took that in. "Of the white men, too?" "The white men, too." Like, dude, his stories are, I mean, that's 3,500 words into a thing, and it just makes you almost drop the page. Or, embarrassingly enough, drop my phone. I'm reading Frank DeFord on an airplane on my phone, which means that civilization is fucking ending. But, like, I mean, those are the things that strike me. It's not stylistic quirks. It's not tricks of the trade. It's not even really the sentences. It's not even really the structure, which is his own thing. It is one that you never get. There's never a picture in your head of Frank DeFord sitting in front of a computer writing. Like, he's never straining. You never ever sort of see through the story he's telling and remember there's a guy somewhere typing this.
Yeah, that's what's well said.
It's amazing.
Is there given that you've sort of reread a lot of his work in the last 48 hours, is there a piece, a quintessential DeFord piece for you that stands above all? And if there is, why?
Well, I mean, they're different ones. I mean, The Boxer and the Blonde, I mean, is nearly perfect in the way that it's like a short story that's true. I mean, it's, you know, maybe the only magazine writer ever who does that better than Frank DeFord is Tom Junot. I mean, that's just like next level shit right there, because it manages to, in an easy conversational way, recreate a world in such a way that you felt like you were in Pittsburgh in the 30s and in the late 30s and 40s, or whenever that was. I'm confusing that with Schmeling. It would have been much, much later than that.
Right.
But anyway, or would it? It would have been 41, right? The Boxer and the Blonde.
I'll find as we're typing. But actually, now that I think about it, it probably is the same era, given Schmeling, Lewis, and the timing on that.
Yeah, exactly. He fought Lewis. I think it was. Because that's the deal, is that it was the summer before war broke out. Like, he recreates that America so well that long after you forget any details about the boxer's life or the blonde's life, and long after you forget the details of the fight, you are left with like a lingering impression of a time and a place. And that's just like, oh my God. I mean, the Bobby Knight thing, as profiles go, like what you want to do is write a profile that comes true. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that's, you know, where you're not just capturing a moment in time. It's not just sort of a dispatch. It is both dispatch and you are seeing the thing that is obvious to you and is not obvious to anyone else. Like that's when they become great. And so, like, those two stories, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of hard to do. I mean, the Bill Russell thing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't, you know. By the way, Bill Russell, what was that, 1999?
1999. And actually, so, and you're by the way, you the Box and the Blonde, you're correct. It's sort of like 36 through, like, 42, 43 as I'm looking at it now.
And like, so think about this. So Frank DeFord was hired in 1962, and, like, I mean, The Boxer and the Blonde came out after Shadow of a Nation.
Right.
Like, that's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah. It's
like, Bill Russell's 2001. I was working for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Do you know what I mean? Like he started on the same day as Dan Jenkins, and he wrote Bill Russell while I was writing newspaper stories. That's ridiculous.
Did you, I know, are someone who has made it a point to seek out and meet some of the people that you considered, you know, the finest sort of writers for you growing up. I know you've met with Gary Smith and others. Did you and DeFord ever interact either in person or via email or phone?
Did not. And in fact, I mean, my travel schedule, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm going to out to San Francisco for the basketball. And I mean, I want to try to go to the funeral. I mean, for no, not, I don't know why actually. But no, I never met him. And I don't understand, really. I mean, those guys are different. Like, I mean, you know, I have my copy that Seth Wickersham gave me for, I think, my college graduation present of You Gotta Play Hurt, the Dan Jenkins book.
Right.
And I took it to Augusta National at least once, maybe twice, to get Dan to sign it and chickened out.
No
like,
kidding.
I just was like, I don't know, man. I'm not going to go bother fucking Dan Jenkins.
It's not that he's honestly not that intimidating a guy. He would have had a conversation with you about it.
Yeah, but he's Jim Tom Pinch. You know what I mean?
Like, I get it. Yeah, I understand.
And so, no, I never did, which is now stupid. And it's also because, I mean, those stories are so above a college student.
Right.
And so, you know, if you grew up while he was actively dropping bombs like that, then the thing you knew was you had the benefit of seeing how those stories landed in the zeitgeist. So even if you didn't understand how he did what he did, you understood it was important. So for me, coming along later, it was just a much different thing. I mean, there were these perfect little stories that, I mean, the Boxer and the Blonde is so much better now than when I first read it. And, like, I imagine that it'll keep getting better. Like, any fault of the story is with the reader, where you're just not ready to get it.
Yeah, that's how I feel about when I read the Connors piece again. It sort of gets better after every reading, which sort of says something about the quality of that profile.
And it's loose and easy. It's not, you know, it's just loose and easy. He never looks like he's straining. So there's not just like some sort of like super tight, obvious, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer narrative arc. He just, like, goes to a place and then comes back and is like, all right, I'm going to tell you some shit I learned. And you don't even really realize what he's doing until, like, halfway through, and you're like, oh, my God. This is all very intentional.
Wright Thompson is a senior writer for ESPN and ESPN, the magazine, obviously, as you can hear in his voice, a great fan of sports journalism at its highest level. Wright, I appreciate you joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. This is a very heavy SI-centric podcast, but I really wanted to get your voice today because I know your love and appreciation for DeFord's work. Thank you very much for joining us today.
No, and I appreciate that. And it's just, man, he just retired a couple of months ago. I mean, it's just sort of like, you know?
Yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah, like, I mean,
You want you want more of a, I don't even know if it's called a farewell tour, but something.
Or just like, he should be able to sit there and drink beer in Key West.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for having me on.
This is Sports Illustrated's Media Podcast with Richard Deitch.
And now we bring in Jack McCallum, a longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated, author of multiple books, NBA Hall of Famer in that wing. And Jack, I'm not sure how long you worked with Frank, but you know, you graced the same pages as he did for many years. And for you, what's his legacy, both I guess as a writing, both for sports writing and as a figure in journalism, literature, et cetera?
Well, I think first of all, Richard, he almost, you hesitate to say someone invented it because, you know, you can get an argument about Edison and Tesla, but the long form piece that was literary and not reverential. That is, there were long pieces written in the old days, but they were pretty much kind of, you know, along the lines of, my God, isn't this guy great? And they were usually participated in, you know, certainly a lot of long pieces about Babe Ruth. But Frank was the one that really brought journalism into these pieces. And I think what's missed about it is the level of reporting that goes into these things. When you start to write bonuses yourself, you realize, yeah, you can sit down and think of all the fancy words you want, but if you didn't do the spade work to do the reporting, it's not going to work. And I think with a guy like Frank, who's known as a graceful writer, what's missed is the amount of reporting that he put into the stories. And the idea of that bonus piece that SI became known for, the piece in the back of the magazine, if you know, which is carried on by Gary Smith, certainly very well by a lot of people afterward, you know, right now, Lee Jenkins, Chris Ballard, Rick Riley did a lot of good ones. Even I did a couple not so great ones. Frank is number one on that list, and I think that's probably his number one legacy.
Jack, how often did you two interact? You're based in Pennsylvania. He was based in either Connecticut, New York, or Florida. So I'm not sure if you two would have ever seen each other in person. Did you interact with him much?
Well, not very much. You know, saw him in the office here and there. And, you know, the funny thing of the first time I ever met Frank, I had to call him up when it was literally my first story for Sports Illustrated. And it was, I had to go down to the NCAA regional basketball tournament in Atlanta to see Danny Ainge. Frank was already there covering the tournament, as I wrote on my blog, for God knows what reason. He must have wanted to go to Atlanta to have dinner or something, and along the way probably wrote this beautiful piece about the tournament. Anyway, and Peter Carey, the former assistant managing editor, said, well, call up Frank, he'll help you get a credential. And I'm going, I can't call up Frank DeFort. You know, I had been reading him by that time for 10 years. No, he's a great guy, and I get Frank on the phone. And before I stammered out an introduction, he said, oh, yeah, you wrote a great piece for us last week about baseball chatter. And, you know, I had my last piece as a freelancer had been about that. And I thought to myself, before I got a chance to tell this guy how much I had appreciated his writing, he complimented me on something that I did. I never forgot that. You know, obviously I'm talking about it, you know, 40-some years later. You know, when somebody that great, you know, can kind of reach down from the pedestal, it's terrific. And the other time, you know, I was with him a couple times, not really very often. He interviewed me about when he wanted to go to the, when he was starting the National. Did not offer me a job, but that's okay. As I wrote on my blog, just knowing you were on the masthead and kind of in the same profession as Frank really made it all seem, you know, a little bit more worthy.
That, by the way, the Jack's website is jackmccallum.net, and the piece that he's talking about is of Frank DeFort in writing lessons. Jack's first assignment for Sports Illustrated, March of 1981. Jack, with you, I want to finish with this. You know, you are, as long as I've known you, you're someone who loves to read. You both edited and wrote for Sports Illustrated. I don't know how many people who listen to this podcast know you were also an editor. So,
probably a mediocre one, but thank you.
Same here. So my piece, my question for you is, what DeFord pieces for you stand out above all and why?
Well, this isn't a notable one, but he wrote a piece about, I'm not sure, if you try to copy someone's style, I don't think you can do it. You know, a lot of people tried to write bad Rick Riley. they couldn't do it. And Frank wrote this story. I was just starting out as a sports writer at a small paper, and he wrote a story about the Harlem Globetrotters. And it was kind of the first one that kind of looked at, well, maybe this is a little bit of a, there's a little bit of old school racism in this endeavor, and questioned some of the things about the Globies. But the way he did it was just so honest and forthright without being, without either sucking up or laying a hatchet to the whole thing. And I read this piece and I read it again. And I swear to you that I came away with it and kind of went, I sort of get this sports writing. I sort of get the tone that you want. You know, I'm not saying that from that moment on I became Frank DeFord, because I never did. But it was just sort of an approach to a story. That one was very, I thought was, just really great the way he did it, and was really important to me. One of the other ones that sticks out, two of them for different reasons, The Boxer and the Blonde about Billy Kahn, and to be able to write that kind of Ring Lardner melodrama without seeming, a little bit overly sentimental or a little bit overly 1930s. Very few people could do that. And the other one was this master of reporting called Raised by Women to Conquer Men, which was about, I'm sure other people will mention it too, which was right. About Jimmy Connors at a point when Connors would not talk to him. And, you know, the lesson there was sometimes you're better off, if somebody won't talk to you, you're better off going around them. Later on, I had kind of that experience with Greg Popovich. And that makes you work all that more harder to get the information when you're not getting it from the first person. Those are a couple of the ones that stick out for me with for Frank.
Jack McCallum wrote for Sports Illustrated for more than 30 years, or 30 years, maybe it was exact. He received the Kurt Gowdy Media Award from the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame in 2005. And maybe his best accomplishment is that he raised a farmer. One of your kids is a farmer, Jack, right? I love that.
That is true. And his two kids are running around my house right now as I get ready to depart for the NBA Finals. So they'll be my wife's responsibility in an hour.
Nice. Way to hand that off. Jack, we always appreciate catching up with you, Jack. McCallum and Michael Farber, of course, were guests of this podcast earlier this year. Jack, safe travels. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. Take it easy.
All right. My thanks to Jack McCallum. And now coming up, Sally Jenkins, the fine sports columnist for The Washington Post, who wrote just a great tribute to Frank DeFord. I should note, by the way, as we're taping this, Sally is in Texas as her father, Dan Jenkins, also a famed Sports Illustrated writer. Sally, am I correct about this? The TCU press box has now been named the Dan Jenkins press box?
That's correct. Yesterday, we cut the ribbon on it. It's at Amon Carter Stadium in Fort Worth, and it's now the Dan Jenkins press box.
Does Dan, does he have, a lifetime pass, or does he still have to get credentials like the rest of us?
Well, he's certainly a lifetime TCU guy. He buys his own tickets, though. He's still a member of the press. He doesn't take favors.
I like that.
Yeah.
All right. One of the things that struck me from the piece that you wrote on Frank DeFord was this quote or comment by you, where you said you always came away liking his subjects for their flaws, not in spite of them, for them. So I wonder how do you think DeFord did that? Because whether it was Connors or Bobby Knight in particular, you walked away from people maybe you loathed before with a touch more humanity, which is pretty impressive as a writer, I think.
Well, I think the most important factor in that is that Frank liked them, and he wasn't afraid to let that come out in his writing. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean that he didn't, that he, you know, somehow pulled a punch. I mean, he wrote about them very truthfully, but with an underlying, I think, affection for all people, you know, that compete. You know, I think he had a central respect for people who put themselves out there and are willing to be examined, you know, in both the field of play, but also by the press.
Sally, when did you arrive at Sports Illustrated? What year?
Oh, gosh, you're really testing my memory now. I mean, 20 years ago, at least.
Okay.
I mean, I was there for 7 years between, I want to say, 1986 or 7.
When you... The reason I'm trying to date that is when you arrived at Sports Illustrated, obviously Frank DeFord had established himself as maybe the premier sports writer in America. Did you, upon coming to the magazine, and again, your father was a very, very well-known writer for that place, but did you have certain thoughts about DeFord as you when you eventually landed at the same place he did?
Well, you know, when I was there, Frank was really going off to start the National. He was involved in that great experiment, the National. And so, you know, I wasn't, I think maybe I was a colleague of his for a very, very brief time before he went off to do that. So he was actually, while I was at Sports Illustrated, viewed very much as the competitor.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Did that change or shape your view? Or
no, I mean, obviously, I think we were all really interested in kind of quietly rooting for Frank to succeed, because I think a lot of us felt that Sports Illustrated could use a little competition and could use a little bit of a challenge. And in fact, I think time showed that Sports Illustrated was sort of eating its young and not near as innovative as it should have been.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more, and that's well said. What do you think, before I ask you about what you consider the most meaningful story of his that you read or noted, what do you think his legacy will be in terms of what he brought to the field of sports writing and maybe what he brought to journalism outside of sports?
Well, I think his legacy really is the championing of long-form sports journalism. You know, the bonus feature in Sports Illustrated, which was the place in the magazine where you weren't afraid to let a story run, you know, for several thousand words. You know, I think that the reason why, you know, new media is actually, you know, in the sports area is happy to still be doing long-form features, you know, whether it's a Chuck Culpepper or a Wright Thompson, is because of Frank. I think had Frank not been doing that work so well, so consistently through, you know, into the digital age, I think it proved that there's readership for a great long story, no matter what the medium.
How well?
I'll just add one thing
please,
to that quickly, which is as a TV journalist at HBO Real Sports, you know, he was terribly influential there too. I mean, if you look at some of the stories he worked on, I mean, one of the things that Frank was really unrelenting on was the corruption of the Olympic movement.
Right.
You know, he was a hell of a reporter, and he was, despite the sweetness in his work, particularly in his feature stories, you know, Frank was a truth teller.
Sally, you wrote that, to me, the most meaningful and complicated, if not best story Frank ever wrote, was about the German heavyweight Max Schmeling. Why, for you, was sort of that the quintessential DeFord piece?
It was the quintessential DeFord piece because of the complexity of the subject and Frank's ability to take on that subject, not be afraid of the moral and emotional complexity of the subject, and not reduce it to some silly kind of, you know, hero-villain narrative. I mean, what I admired so much about Frank's work was, you know, he didn't fall into sports fairy tale, you know. He didn't write children's literature. You know, he treated sports subjects like the complicated subjects they really, really are. And I think the Schmeling piece, because Schmeling is such a complicated story, you know, he was a poster boy for the Nazis, and yet he wasn't a Nazi. He took favors from Hitler and even for a while kept a picture of Hitler on the wall of his study, and yet he sheltered Jews and fought very hard to protect his Jewish trainer. I mean, that is a tough subject to kind of humanize your subject and help people understand what was really going on there. And so to me, it was the degree of difficulty there, getting the interview with Schmeling in the first place, getting him to talk to you about all of that, was really a feat to me.
Yeah, I would recommend anyone go back and check that piece out in the SI archives. Finally, Sally, how well did you know Frank? Did your paths cross because of your dad, or did you see him along the way for different assignments?
I did not know Frank very well. I know him to say hi to. I remember running into him on a train from between New York and Washington. He lived over in Baltimore, I believe. I ran into him around the tennis world. I mean, we were professional colleagues, but I certainly can't say that we knew each other real well. But Frank, everybody knew Frank. He was so friendly. You know, he never lorded it above younger sports writers. I mean, you know that, and Wright knows that. Everyone who was around him, he was very, very generous and very kind to all sports writers, especially younger ones.
Yeah,
like me.
The rare God who lived among the living, basically.
Yes, exactly. He didn't have an ounce of pretension. He really was the nicest man. He treated you like an equal.
Yeah, which is cool, because there's a lot far lesser writers and talents who treat people like assholes. So that was nice of like Frank DeFord to sort of be among us. Sally Jenkins is the fine sports columnist for The Washington Post. Please check out her work, and particularly her column that she wrote a couple of days ago on Frank DeFord's life and life, writing life, I should say. Sally, thanks so much for taking the time today to give us some reflections on Frank DeFord. Sally Jenkins, by the way, has been a guest on this podcast. Please check out her episode as well. Sally, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, my thanks to Sally Jenkins. And now we bring in Tim Layden, the fine, longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Tim, you know, you are someone, obviously we are friends for a long time, so I know how much you respect really good journalism. And, your era at Sports Illustrated sort of follows DeFord at his heights. And I wonder, just in terms of influence, did you, when you were younger, read DeFord, and were there particular stories that he wrote that had a great impression on you and maybe forged in your mind, hey, I want to get to Sports Illustrated and be on the same pages as Frank DeFord?
Sure, without a doubt. I mean, Frank DeFord came to SI in 62. My first SI subscription was in 65 when I was 9 years old. And then I graduated from college in 78, which, and went to work in Albany and Schenectady, medium-sized papers, doing everything, you know, from high schools to youth sports to, you know, taking phone calls. And when you're in that kind of job, what you want to do is get to a better place. And SI would arrive every Thursday, and I would look for it. And what you want to do is, what I wound up doing is reading, just devouring everything that everybody wrote, but in particular, all the stuff at the back of the book, which I came to find out later in life were called bonus pieces. I didn't even know that at the time. And you would just read Frank's stuff. And then I think what I and probably anybody else with ambition at that time would do is you would then try and take some kernel of what Frank wrote or the whole of what he wrote and try and apply it to the next thing you did. And usually it was crazy inappropriate. It was, you were writing some story on a high school football coach and for 700 words and you try and make it into a Frank DeFord story. But he would just, that's the way that he would just impart himself on you, even though I didn't know the guy, even though I only knew his work. And it was just basically his work at that point in my life when I was in my 20s and early 30s was just the grail. And it sort of gave me the idea that this is something I can chase. I can try to be like this guy because this is the guy who's doing it like nobody else ever has, at least to my knowledge. You know, I kind of said that on Twitter, and a few people reminded me of, you know, Gay Talese and W.C. Hinds and people like that. But I think Frank was the first guy that really did what we think of as, I'm not even going to use that word, that two-syllable word that people use for stories that aren't short. But he was the first guy to do it every few weeks or every month on a consistent basis and with a powerful voice all the time. And, he was just incredibly important to the early years of my career without knowing him even.
Tim, one of the things that you have become a specialist in is what I don't know if you would refer to it, but I'll refer to it sort of as a parachute piece where you you can parachute into a story or a situation or a profile, not necessarily covering that sport, and in a fairly short amount of time put together a world-class profile or world-class feature on that particular subject. DeFord may be one of the masters of this craft. I know he covered the NBA early in his career, but at a certain point of his career, he would go from Jimmy Connors to Bobby Knight to Howard Cosell to later in his writing life, Bill Russell. The guy's ability, at least in my mind, to write so many different subject matters, but yet to get so in-depth on his profile subject is extraordinary. I guess for you, Tim, I would just want your observations as, I mean, how does someone do that? Was he just sort of gifted by the gods and he had that ability as a writer and maybe a person to be curious? But that to me is just an incredible skill that DeFord was not, he was not a single sports specialist. He was a generalist, but everything he touched was of the highest order.
Yeah, it seems so contrary now to what we see on a daily basis where everybody makes their, everybody earns their chops by being a specialist in something. And to me, you know, Frank was the guy, you know, you mentioned all those pieces that, you know, Bobby Knight and Bill Russell and Howard Cosell that had been traded around so much in the last few days. And I did a couple of podcasts earlier this week, yesterday and the day before on the word in the horse racing world. And Frank did the Sportsman of the Year piece on Steve Coffin in 1978. That's a name that nobody remembers anymore, but Steve Coffin was this young jockey who took the whole racing world by storm when he was 17 years old in 1977-78, and he was Sportsman of the Year. And Frank wrote 7,000 words on Coffin, tremendous eloquence and knowledge about the sport. And I think he did one other piece a few years earlier, a tragic piece on this jockey in Rhode Island who died young and lived a very, very difficult life. And it was just an incredible piece that really wasn't about horse racing so much as it was just about a life that was an uphill climb for a human being. And the kind of story you see often that feature writers try to find now, the untold story. And that was clearly one of those. But to me, that what you described, that the whole not having to be a specialist, I mean, everything Frank did had this confidence about it. And you could see that looking at the pictures of him with the way he dressed. You could see the way he carried himself on television in the later part of his life, and it shined through so much in his writing that he, from word one until word 6,235 of some long piece, Frank was in charge of what he was doing, and he was confident. There was no pulling back from what he was trying to say. He could be subtle in the way that he would describe a character, but it was a powerful subtlety, and there was just tremendous confidence that he had when he was sitting at the keyboard, and it just bled right off the page when you were seeing it. And you're so right that it didn't matter what the subject was. He clearly had I've seen him say a few times, I've seen it quoted a few times, that he didn't really love sports, but clearly he loved everything about sports. And he knew every world. He knew every little corner of sports, even if he wasn't a fan with a capital F.
Tim, last one for me is there a piece, is there a particular Ford piece for you that was the quintessential piece for you?
It sounds cliched, but one and two for me are Howard Cosell and Bobby Knight. The Cosell piece, which again doesn't get passed around quite as much, but has in the last few days. It just, again, it had this power to it, and it was at a time when, I had met Cosell a couple times, and I had a couple really lousy exchanges with him. I met him when I was a college student, and I met him early in my career, and Frank wrote about him in such a way that really, to me, captured the edge and the insecurity and the meanness, but also the intellectual power and the place on the media landscape, I just thought it was incredible. I just thought it was quintessential DeFord, just because it was an area that it was a difficult area, and it was a lot of the stuff he did was difficult. He took on challenging topics and got to the bottom of where they existed, and I thought Cosell was an incredibly complex character and the kind of character that really doesn't exist in sports right now, in sports media either. And I just thought he found the heart and soul of the guy and also the dark side of him. And I just thought it was amazing.
Tim Layden is a longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Tim, you're working on a story right now. Are you allowed to say what it is as I call you or no?
Sure. Yeah, there aren't that many secrets. I'm doing two stories at once, but right now I'm in California. I'm doing SI has what's called the Where Are They Now issue every year. It's very popular. And I'm doing a story on Victor Conti, the mastermind of Balco, who provided steroids to a lot of famous athletes and went down in the investigation and went to prison and is now back in the athletic training and supplement business and meeting with him today in San Francisco to see what's up with him.
Wow.
And shortly after that, I'm doing a story on a distance runner who's competing with, despite the fact that she has stage 4 cancer and is continuing her career. And I'm doing a kind of a long piece on her.
Wow.
So we'll juggling those two things.
Yeah, we'll look for those two stories. Tim Layden, we appreciate your remembrances today.
Yeah, Richard, before I go, just one last thing I wanted to say about Frank is that, you know, a lot of times when I talk to young journalists, I tell them that one of the great tools you have as a writer is the ability to transport a reader to a time and place and to put them there. And if you go back and read a piece like, and Frank did a number of historical pieces, but he also did this with his pieces that were set in the present time. But go back and read The Boxer and the Blonde, which I'm sure many people are going to evoke as just maybe his greatest literary triumph, aside from the many books he wrote. But when you read that piece, I mean, you are absolutely in 1941 witnessing that fight. And you can smell it, and you can hear it, and you can taste it. And it's just, it's so powerful that the skill that Frank had in evoking a different time and a different place and a different era. And you think to the way things are done now, and I'm just going to say Frank DeFord would never write an oral history of something that happened in the past. He would write the hell out of it and make you be there. He wouldn't just use disconnected voices to get through to the end of the story. And it's somewhat of a lost art, but nobody has ever done it better than Frank did. And you know, I said to people earlier this week, if you're just going to go back and read one piece that will really help you understand him, maybe if it's not my personal piece or somebody else's, go back and read The Boxer and the Blonde just for the way that he evoked an era and a time and a place.
Tim Layden, longtime senior writer for Sports Illustrated, we appreciate your remembrances of Frank DeFord.
Thanks very much, Richard.
This is Sports Illustrated's Media Podcast with Richard Deitch.
Okay, again, my thanks to Tim Layden, and we bring on Michael Farber, a longtime Sports Illustrated senior writer, a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame, currently does a lot of work now for TSN in Canada. Michael, one, I appreciate you returning to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. You have been a guest on this podcast, but you first met Frank DeFord in 1974 when you were working, I believe, either on a tennis story or in tennis. Can you tell me about that reflection?
I was working for World Championship Tennis. I'd left newspapers, turned out to be briefly, for a year. I was working in public relations for WCT, the Lamar Hunt Group. And, strangely enough, I was in Montreal, where I now live, and it was the World Doubles Championship. And Frank DeFord was writing about it for Sports Illustrated. And what I remember most is that there was some kind of small media gift, as there are at big events. Something incredibly insignificant. I can't even remember what it was. It was nothing of any real value. It might have been a pen, the WCT logo, or something truly of minimal value. And I offered it, of course, to Frank DeFord of Sports Illustrated, and he declined it, saying, no, we don't accept anything. That's how we do business. And he was the only person in the media to refuse the gift. And I said, okay, that's something. This is impressive or principled. And I said, I didn't find it rude. I found it principled. It was also, as it turned out, the first time I ever bumped into SI fact checkers. because after he filed the story, they called me and verified various things. And at one point, he had talked about a doubles pair from two places. And I said, yeah, and there's also a doubles pair, and there was an Egyptian named Izzy El Sharif, as I recall, playing with Britain, I think. And he, that's good. So they actually added a line in Frank DeFord's story. And so I helped him become what he is today.
that's big.
Because I mentioned this doubles pair. But that was the first time I met Frank.
Did you obviously spent most of your adult life in Canada, but you are from New Jersey and grew up in the States. Did his writing in Sports Illustrated impact you in your formative sports journalism years? And if so, how?
Oh, sure. When Frank DeFord had a piece in Sports Illustrated, it's almost like hockey games on Saturday night in Canada. Or when John McPhee's name would appear on the flap of the New Yorker magazine, if you buy it on the newsstand, it somehow felt bigger. And so I was always excited as a consumer of sports journalism before, or just as I was getting into the business, if there was a Frank DeFord piece in SI. I think his power of observation and his ability to express it is really what caught my eye. He just saw things that other people didn't. He thought better than other people, and thinking and writing obviously are connected at the hip. And he was really the first long-form journalist that I paid attention to. This was in the days before long-form was even a word, maybe even a concept. So, yeah, I don't think there are certain writers that you just couldn't, you could admire but not emulate because of their style, because you knew you didn't think as well as Frank DeFord or see the world the same way. There were stylists like Lee Montville that you couldn't imitate because he was unique. One of our former SI colleagues, well, Frank DeFord was the same way. And if Frank DeFord were at an event, it somehow became even bigger, or if he had picked out a subject, it mattered more.
Are there any pieces, Mike, that for you stand out above the rest? And a lot of the remembrances today from my other guests, and you know, Jack and Ry Thompson, Sally Jenkins, Tim Layden, they didn't mention hockey pieces. So I'm wondering for you, as someone who's has dedicated his life to covering hockey, are there any pieces that DeFord did in that sport that really stood out to you?
Well, the Bobby Orr piece, very early on. And the lead is about the waters of the Sound being the green waters of the Sound. I want to get this right. They would, in a month or so, they would yield to the ice. And just the lead always struck me. If you're looking for great leads, and who isn't always looking for great leads? And that was it. But Frank was also a product of his time, and I'm sure Tim Layden has pointed that out. And I think that's real great insight into him. I'm going to actually read something that was in the story, which I believe was 66. Bobby Orr played 1 year in the original six. He was a rookie the 66-67 season. And this is what Frank wrote. "It is just a sad, friendly little place," and he's talking about Orr's hometown of Parry Sound, Ontario, "the kind of town where the men stop to peer carefully into hardware store windows and where the pretty girls turn fat before they grow old." Would you be writing that in 2017?
No, probably not if you want to work for a major national outlet.
Yeah, probably not. But it might have been very keenly observed. But it's kind of troubling in some way. In the 60s, the Mad Men generation, that wouldn't have, other than saying, gee, that's keenly observed, no one would have thought twice about it. But Frank was never terribly interested in hockey, even though he once tried to hire me to write hockey for him at the National.
What was that? Well, but yeah, let's not leave that for a second. So you had told me that he tried to hire you at the National in 1989. So how did Frank DeFord, the executive, make a pitch to Michael Farber for a job?
I would say unsuccessfully. but you know, Frank, I went to lunch with him in New York, and it was an odd time. I was down in Atlantic City covering a fight for the Montreal Gazette where I worked, and within 3 days I had two job offers, one from Sports Illustrated, which I turned down, although I would accept it later again, start working at the magazine in 1994, and one from the National. Well, that involved lunch with Frank in New York, and I made sure I dressed well because Frank always dressed well. He carried himself. There was such style there, and so I didn't want to make a fool of myself. But the National struck me as a great idea. I just didn't see how it was going to work, and in fact, 18 months later, it didn't. But Frank's offer was to write hockey, but to write hockey notes columns and, you know, cover the sport, the minutiae of the sport. And if you wanted to be at all like Frank DeFord, you wanted to write grand sweeping stuff. So the job didn't appeal to me at all, strangely enough. But we had a very nice lunch. And when you're sitting with Frank DeFord, you know, you felt good about yourself. If Frank thought you were good enough to work for his publication, you know, that was a nice thing.
Here's a final one, Mike. Why do you think his work sort of stands the test of time? I mean, maybe we're not going to know that for a while, but you know, where there are certain very famous writers, sports writers from the 40s, 50s, and 60s who we don't really sort of think about anymore, but you know, people like Hines still talk about. Grantland Rice, maybe that has to do with Grantland, although his prose wasn't always the greatest. But it's the outpouring for DeFord in the last 48 hours strikes me that his work isn't going away. And his work, even when you read it today, and you mentioned the Orr thing, but there are other profiles, particularly the Bobby Knight profile or the Jimmy Connors profile, where if SI published that in 2017, they hold. That's kind of what's amazing about a lot of DeFord's writing, in my opinion.
Well, you go back, you mentioned the old sports writers, and you read Red Smith, who was Frank's role model, and Red Smith is as vibrant today, again, a product of his time. There'll be some things that would make you arch an eyebrow reading Red Smith, but they still hold up wonderfully. If you read Jimmy Cannon, say, not so much.
Right.
Arthur Daly of the Times, a columnist, that doesn't hold. So Frank's holds because he saw some universal truth, and because really he was the first of his kind. I would venture to say, of all the great people you and I have been lucky to work with, Frank is the most important writer in the history of the magazine. I mean, you can make the case perhaps for Dan Jenkins, but I would say it's Frank, because the bonus piece, as it's called in Sports Illustrated, and that was the heartbeat, I always thought, of the magazine of that certain era, and that's he established it. Gary Smith continued the tradition. There have been great long-form writers, including the chronically underappreciated Richard Hoffer, but Frank was the guy. And because he wrote with an eloquence that it's not going to diminish over time, because well-written prose is going to stay around. And he decried the numberization of sports writing, that it became all about the stats and became about the quotes. For Frank, it was the power of observation and the ability to express that. That's why I think he will stay around for as long as people are reading good sports writing.
That's well said. It's subjective as to who you think is the best writer. To me, the best writer in the history of Sports Illustrated is William Knack, but that's subjective. What I think is objective is what you just said. I think Frank DeFord is the most important writer in Sports Illustrated history, and I think if you are a fan of the brand and if you are objective about it, I think that's the conclusion you would come to. But you're no slouch yourself, Farber.
Yeah. You know what? Different league.
We're all in different leagues. All right, Michael Farber is a longtime writer for Sports Illustrated. He's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. You can catch his work now on TSN. Farber, other than swanning the bistros of Montreal, are you doing anything else these days?
Oh, I do some consulting for NBC on hockey, and I'm a hell of a grandfather.
Nice. Very important title. Michael Farber, we appreciate, who has been a guest of this podcast, by the way, with Jack McCallum. Please check that episode out. Michael Farber, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, well, back in the studio here, let's wrap up quick. My thanks to all my guests, Alex Wolf, Jack McCallum, Sally Jenkins, Wright Thompson, Tim Layden, and Michael Farber, for their really thoughtful remembrances of Frank DeFord, one of the giants of sports writing who passed away a couple of days ago. Obviously, given this is a podcast that runs under the aegis of Sports Illustrated, as Michael Farber sort of gave you the end note, I think the most important writer in the history of Sports Illustrated, his work and legacy will not be forgotten soon. So you could check out all the 120-plus episodes on Apple Podcasts. For my producer, Lou Pellegrino, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.